This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome back to Radio 314. This is Lana. Thank you for downloading this program. I'm happy to present John Rappaport, who has worked as an investigative reporter for 30 years, writing articles on politics, medicine, and health. John has delivered lectures and seminars on global politics, health, logic, and creative power to audiences around the world. Welcome, John. How are you today?
Very good, thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to be speaking with you. I was actually very excited that you agreed to come on because of your life experiences and your body of knowledge. So before we get into the question of who runs the world and what we can do about it, let's begin with your background and what sparked your awakening of what really lies beneath the surface.
Okay, well, I started working as a reporter in 1982 in Los Angeles for LA Weekly. It was a lark at the beginning, really. I had a friend who worked there. They were looking for an article of a certain kind, and I knew a source who had that information, and I interviewed him, and they put it on the cover, and they paid me a check, and I thought that was pretty easy. So I continued to write articles for the Weekly, and that began to spread, and I found that I could publish articles in other newspapers and magazines, and I did that for about 6 years, and then I saw that some of the material that I became interested in, you know, you can only cover stories for so long if you have some brain cells working until you ask deeper questions. Who's running this? Who's behind this? And so forth. I found that I had some difficulty with getting my stories into print, and of course, people have to remember that in those days there was no web, and if you published a story, you know, you had to pitch it to an editor first, and then you get an assignment, and then you go write it, and you send it in, and this whole process, depending on whether you're writing for a newspaper or magazine, could take as long as, you know, a month or two before you actually saw your story in print. So I then started to write books. First book came out in 1988 called AIDS, Inc., Scandal of the Century, and that was followed by a book about the Oklahoma bombing in 1995. And then I was working with a publisher doing a lot of different things, including a radio show. And finally, in 2001, I decided, okay, it's time to find out what the web is really all about. And so I started my website, No More Fake News. And just the thrill of the word processing function of computers was enough to hook me. You know, I was basically a reporter with a typewriter. Mm-hmm. And so this was incredible. And then on top of that, the idea that I could actually publish my stories a few seconds after I wrote them and wouldn't have to worry about arguing with editors on content and subject, I was off and running. And that was just before 9/11, and I've been at it ever since.
Wow. Well, you've conducted interviews with Matrix insiders, as you've called them, who know how the major illusions of our world are put together. But let's first define what the Matrix is, and then we can dive in and discuss what the major illusions are within it.
Sure. It's basically a hypnotic trance. It's like a tap dance between the world and people, we who live in it. And there are various layers and levels, and you could make a list of subjects and you would be looking at those levels. I mean, political, social, economic, military, intelligence, energy, medical, food, corporations, government, on and on. The players behind the scenes, and then, however, even deeper than that, and this is really the subject of one of my products called Collections, The Matrix Revealed, by what principles is reality itself defined for us? who, what are the artists, in heavy quotes, doing to design what most people take to be reality?
Mm-hmm.
How would they operate this machine? And what does that do to people? What does it do to their minds? What does it do to their spirit? What does it do to their psyche? And so forth. So this investigation, which lasted many years, really even starting before I became a reporter, was looking at the displacement of power and energy away from the individual and onto a group or groups of people who had figured out a way to, as I used to put it, paint a gigantic mural and call it reality, and thereby extract power from individuals. So that's kind of the kernel of the answer. It can get a lot more complicated than that, but that's really where we would start.
So what are the ways in which these matrix creators manufacture reality?
Well, this goes back as far as history, recorded, unrecorded, on the planet.
Sure.
On one level, they are creating what I call a necessary illusion. They're saying to the populace, whether they're the priest class in ancient civilizations who have claims that they, you know, rule by divine right, or they have special knowledge of esoteric matters, whether they're politicians, kings, etc. They say, here is the way that not only the world but the universe works, and we can show it to you in some fashion, but you have to trust us and believe in us, and if you don't, then you'll never be able to see what's really going on. So you have to take us on faith. And once you do, then everything will be revealed to you. So they begin sort of on that basis. Of course, they also have armies. They also have police. They also have rules. They also have staged events, just like the events that we've seen in Aurora, in Sandy Hook, in Boston lately, to convince people that there are certain enemies out there that need to be conquered. In order for that to happen, everybody has to pull together and sacrifice and give up their freedom and so forth. So these formulas are very, very old. But underneath that, what I discovered is something to me which is far more profound, and that is the replacement of the power of the imagination of the individual in various ways, and the substitution for it of the imagination of people that are basically part of secret societies. And it's gotten to the point, and has really been the case for a very long time, where people don't even believe that imagination is very important, or that it really has much of an impact on the world, or that one could use it to change the world. It's a toy for children. You play around with it, you grow up, and now you're an adult and you have to make your way in the world, and that was a great deal of fun, but that's over. And my experience, many experiences, told me that it was quite the opposite. That the formula of the secret society, as I call it in my 1999 book, The Secret Behind Secret Societies, is to substitute the imagination of perverse artists who paint reality and force it on people and convince people to accept it, the substitution of that for the limitless creative power of a person's own imagination, and that is the power to invent reality. This has been sprinkled throughout history, here and there, now and then. groups have understood this. Individuals have understood this. Most notably, I would say, in early Tibetan civilization. But that has been overwhelmed eventually, that power of the individual to create reality in far-reaching terms by, you know, a class, an elite class, who doesn't want that power to leave their own hands.
Do you think that some of those people are also in the entertainment industry who know these principles? And they're using mind control basically to prop up this matrix through their films and through their music. A lot of this stuff lacks imagination, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that is absolutely true. I mean, most of the people involved in, you know, the image factory of Hollywood are just trying to make a living or succeed. And so they try to sniff which way the winds are blowing and the trends are going, and they go along with whatever they think is going to help them succeed. Just like in any sort of conspiracy, the overwhelming majority of people have no clue about what they're doing or why. It's everything is compartmentalized. At the top, yes, I absolutely think that there is manipulation and mind control going on by overwhelming people with what looks like, you know, you walk into a movie theater and there's some sort of a science fiction extravaganza thriller, and you look at all the special effects and you look at all the ridiculous acting and you look at the stupid plot lines, but you're drawn in to a degree. The movies are telling people, this is energy. We represent energy. And if you sit in the theater in the dark for an hour and a half, you will get vicariously a piece of that energy, and you can walk out feeling better than you did when you walked in. And that formula is, again, a complete reversal on the truth, which is that the individual has unlimited energy of his own, her own, if he can tap into it, if he can find it, if he can invent it, create it. But Hollywood is energy by proxy. You're not doing it as the audience. It's happening to you. That's mm-hmm. the mode. And so the people who put together entertainment, whether it's music or movies or television, their whole impetus is to blast you into a realm where you think the only place you can really get this kind of energy is in the middle of a gigantic concert hall or in a movie theater or sitting in front of a big flat screen in your living room, that otherwise life is prosaic, it's every day, it's a struggle, it's mundane, there's nothing you can really do about it, but you can get a glimpse of what the image makers can give you if you pay your money. And also, there's, of course, a perversion of any sense of morality, any sense of what I would call real humanity that pervades many of the productions of the Hollywood industry. And that further degrades people and gets them to think that, you know, life itself is basically not a very pretty picture and doesn't even have the potential to be. So, yes, I agree with you. Hollywood is definitely involved and has been ever since they discovered that people would walk into a movie theater and sit down and pay money to watch images flickering on the screen.
In your view, do you think there ever was an era of magic on this planet when people were imaginative artists?
Well, you know, I talk about that in some of my audio presentations. And sometimes I'm talking from metaphor. Sometimes I'm talking for what I truly believe to be reality. I think there was a time beyond recorded history when that was the case in certain places, where people, through the power of imagination and their own experience with their own imagination and faith in it, were able to produce far more in the way of new realities than we see today. This society has become technological machine, exceedingly rational, and it's succeeded brilliantly in a number of respects, but it's left behind that, you know, magical organ, you could call it, that people used to be a lot more aware of and could exercise with a lot more power than now. So yes, I think there were times and places where that was much more prevalent than it is now. But it wasn't a trick. It wasn't like, well, if you learn to stand on your head, then everything's going to change. It was a way of life. It was, people lived drenched in imagination. And they still can. And as individuals, they still can. It's still here. It's still in the psyche. It's still that potential. It never goes away. There's nothing that can be done to take it away, and that's one of the reasons why we see such an extraordinary effort on the part of the controllers to invent, manufacture reality for people and to make it as awesome, involving, and even frightening as possible.
Well, from your research, who does run the planet?
Well, I would say a number of groups. I've called them cartels. They compete with each other. They cooperate with each other. They're organically evolving. It's not just six guys sitting in a room. It is six guys sitting in a room, but there are a lot of rooms. But over time, what these people have discovered is that it pays them to cooperate more with each other than to compete. And they have front organizations, which some of which are quite visible. Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, Bilderberg Group, CIA. You could even take that into certain inner sanctums of the FDA and the American Medical Association. You can take that into the Federal Reserve. You can take that into the International Monetary Fund. You can take that into the Tavistock Institute in England, where they have done a considerable amount of research on psychological warfare and mind control. There are these groups. They were formed originally to collect certain people that the controllers, so to speak, thought would be beneficial to have in the fraternity. So they have a public face, and then they have a private inner sanctum, these what I call front organizations. The Vatican also has that same thing going. They have a public face, and then there are very, very private dealings. And over time, as I've said, these forces become more cooperative among themselves than competitive. And they have basically settled on an agenda of globalism. So we're talking about the whole Rockefeller dynasty and how that expands or has expanded through history in many, many aspects of energy, medicine, banking, and so forth and so on. They promote wars because they know that wars weaken sovereign nations. They try to and succeed in bankrupting nations. They want to run the planet like a town or a city with a mayor and a bureaucracy. That's their goal. It has been for a very, very long time. So we have that. And I would say there are still more esoteric layers behind that. But that's certainly good for a starter. And so what you're seeing is a vertical integration of these various cartels in the realms of, as I mentioned before, energy, medicine, money, intelligence, military, government. And then you have mega corporations also feeding into this. They all see a future in which they control the entire planet. They can feel it. They believe it's within their grasp. They already control a tremendous amount, and they're looking for, always for more. And they are kind of a hierarchy that shuffles and reshuffles and learns how to cooperate among themselves for their goal.
Yeah, I wonder about their ultimate goal, because it seems like their obsession to manufacture reality seems like something beyond something physical. It most definitely has to be something esoteric or spiritual. So what do they know?
Well, this is a fascinating area. I'll take you back to ancient Tibet. The ancient Tibetans, before they became a theocracy, were the place, or Tibet was the place, where itinerant teachers, rebels from the academies, from the spiritual systems of India, wandered in about 1500 years ago. And their doctrine was extremely radical. It was also somewhat stripped down from all the metaphysical baggage of Asia. And the principal core was the physical universe is a product of mind, M-I-N-D. Beginning of story, end of story. There it is right there. They not only taught that, but they instructed in exercises and techniques in order to surpass the amnesia, the creative / spiritual amnesia in which the populace found itself without even knowing why. So that's what it led with, you might say. The universe is a product of mind, and if you want to become a committed practitioner of certain techniques and exercises, you can discover that for yourself, which you have to, in order to do anything about it. And that was a revolution, such as the planet has never seen, for perhaps 100 years, until it became diluted, until rituals and ceremonies began to enter in, until a priesthood class tried to take the whole thing over, until today we have, you know, a very, very watered-down version of that. The Tibetans who are practicing today and teaching understand some of this, but most of them view it as, you know, way out there over the horizon, a faint glint of possible light somewhere in the future. They are not nearly in any way, shape, or fashion as intense about the practices as were these magicians, really, as I call them, that existed in ancient Tibet. And that became an intense focus of my research, because I said, okay, how far can we take this? Just as you asked, if we're talking about control, mind control, and a degree of manufacturing reality at a very, very profound level, you know, how many floors are there when you take the elevator down? You know, and when I came upon this, I knew that I had found something that would then, it was a door that opened for me, and I said, okay, I am going to walk through here, and I'm going to become a practitioner of my own for myself and really discover as much as I can about these techniques, practice them on an intense basis, but also eventually came to the conclusion that for modern times, these exercises and techniques had to be reshaped and reworked, or let's say added on to considerably, so that anybody could do them and anybody would have the motivation to do them. And I've been doing them now for, I don't know, 25 years or so.
So I have to ask you, do you know, what did the Nazis look for in Tibet in the 30s? Maybe they knew some of this?
I think they had an inkling. You know, the Nazis sent people to Tibet before World War II to do as much research as possible into, A, the myth of the lost Aryan race, and B, the power of manifestation. And there is trying to remember the title of the book and the author now. I've got it somewhere in my library. I Saw Hitler Make Black Magic is the title. It's a pamphlet of about 35 pages. And I think the author, he was an American doctor who was in Germany before the outbreak of the war. Kenneth, can't think of his last name at the moment. But he was a stage magician. He met Hitler. He met some of his lieutenants. He was also an intelligence operative on the American side. And he gained access to Hitler's secret hideout high in the mountains. And he said that when he walked in there, one of the things he saw were many, many practitioners sitting in front of large posted photographs on the wall, extremely well done photographs, doctored photographs of locations in Czechoslovakia. And in these photographs, interiors of houses, streets, and so forth, the Nazi flags were flying, photographs of Hitler were on the walls. It was as if the invasion had already succeeded. And these practitioners were sitting there in shifts around the clock, trying to visualize and manifest this destiny for the Third Reich. So, you know, the account that he gave has been questioned. It has been scoffed at and so forth.
Kenneth Walker was the name, by the way, of the author.
Kenneth Walker, there you go. Very good. And this is what he saw. I think it's true from other material that I, you know, researched, including Peter Lavenda's books on Nazis and the esoteric arts, secret societies, and so forth. So absolutely, the Nazis were looking for whatever they could find in this respect when they sent people to Tibet. But unfortunately for them, and fortunately for us, most people, when they enter this whole arena of investigation and research, are looking for tricks. It's not a trick. You can't. It's not like, oh, well, if I blink my eye and, you know, try to look up through the top of my head and twitch my elbow, suddenly I'll have access to something that I never knew I had before. It's a life. You live that life. You're committed to a life of imagination and creative power to find what are the limits of your own creative power, if any. And that's something that relatively few people are prepared for.
Yeah, it's a lifestyle, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's really not a style even. You know, it goes beyond any style, I would say.
Maybe that's why they try and beat out imagination out of kids right away in school.
They do this, you see. And even the word style, you see, because what are we confronted with in society today? A whole series of lifestyles, any one of which you can pick from as if you're shopping for clothes in a store, But as you pursue these, you know, as you go into them, oh, well, I think I'll do this, and I'll look this way, and I'll act that way, and I'll take a role in the grand stage play and so forth. You know, people by their 30s or 40s, they reach a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they say, God, this was some sort of an illusion. They get very, you know, morose about it. And yes, this is also why in schools, imagination is pounded out of kids immediately because, you know, there's nothing there that has anything to do with imagination, and you're sitting in the classroom hour after hour after hour after hour, day after day after day, and when you emerge on the other side, you know, they are hoping that you're going to be kind of a machine that fits into the larger machine of the society that they've designed. And I don't know whether you're familiar with the original Summerhill School in England,
mm-hmm.
but this was a school that was designed on the opposite principle, that if you let kids exercise their imagination to the fullest, without interference, without guidance, without props, without adults, but just, you know, enough supervision so that they didn't end up killing each other, extraordinary things would happen to children.
I'd agree.
And they did, and they do.
You wrote a terrific piece, I think, which fits in perfectly with this subject, called The Artist Against the System. I wanted to read a small portion of it, but everyone really should go read this in its entirety. Okay, it goes, "The trend now, under various guises, is the collective. We need to realize that the collective, no matter how it is defined or shaped or covertly hidden, is seeking to marginalize the person who imagines and creates new realities. The artist is capable to spot the collective. He opposes it. This opposition can't be settled and resolved with some absurd rainbow philosophy that pretends to include everybody. It can't be dismissed or merged in a melting lump of happy, happy cosmic cheese."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's another major theme. The artist against the system. I was giving a talk in L.A., and I think it was 1995. I had just run for a seat in U.S. Congress in Los Angeles and became convinced that the vote count was rigged and marshaled some evidence for that. And so I was in a bookstore, I think at the time, in Santa Monica, and I was giving a talk, and right in the middle of the talk, I was looking at somebody in the audience, and I don't know why this happened, but I said, "This is a lot bigger than an election, folks, as we all know. This is a revolution against the empire." And that phrase stuck in my mind. And it brought back to me an unnamed, unremembered science fiction novel that I had read much earlier in my life that started with a little carpenter working in a little tiny cottage in a little tiny town on a planet that was part of a planetary system and a galactic system of what we would now call globalism, except it spanned a gigantic amount of space. And it told the story of how from this tiny cottage was born a revolution against the entire empire. And from that moment on, I was utterly convinced, yeah, it is the artist against the system, in the sense that everybody can be an artist in the widest sense of that term. Unfortunately, most people have a very flattened view of what they want to create. And I've knocked my head against the wall over and over and over again with this over the years until I finally just became immune to the whole thing, which was this, that somebody would take a seminar of mine or hear a lecture of mine, and they would come back to me months later and they would say something which I will describe in a metaphor that I frequently use. I say, well, you know, I was operating a beauty shop, and now after going through, you know, your material, I don't only have 6 shades of nail polish, I have 13. And that has changed my life. to illustrate that many people are so completely hypnotized by this culture that if you talk to them about creative power, they immediately translate down into something so extraordinarily superficial that you almost can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But the artist against the system is exactly the conflict that we're dealing with here, or the revolution that we're dealing with here. Are you going to succumb to the reality that's presented to you? And by reality, as we've been discussing here, I mean it all the way down and all the way up and all the way out on all levels. Or are you going to find out how you can imagine and invent your own reality again with no limits whatsoever? Which way are you going to jump? That's the revolutionary decision that people make one way or another. They either surrender and give in. And if they give in, what they're giving into is collectivism.
Mm-hmm.
Collectivism is, there really is nobody home. You're not home, I'm not home, anybody listening to this isn't home. There is no such thing as the individual. It never really did exist. It was always a myth. It was some sort of a fiction that was invented to satisfy the power hunger of certain people. But now we have something that is much more humane and much more successful, and that is the group. And that's all there is, and that's all there really ever was. And you have to learn that, and we will teach it to you time and time and time again until you finally surrender, at which point you will be merged into the great cosmic melting cheese of the group. That's it.
Yeah, this matrix needs you to be in a collective. It doesn't want free individuals imagining and creating, because then they can't be controlled. They're not trapped within the limits anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the proposition, see, because they really don't have any other alternative, the controllers. If they're going to say and promote and teach and herald the individual as the prime element, you might say, in a cosmology of the present and future, they're going to lose all control. The other alternative is the group, the collective. That's it. Melt everybody down. Use whatever means necessary to convince people that what this collective really is the spiritual culmination that everyone has always been looking for, you see. Because you can't just say, hey, let's join the collective. Come on, everybody. No, you have to artfully embellish it. You have to be an extreme deceiver. You have to present out front images and ideas and words and so on and feelings that prompt in people the achievement of the highest goal that they've ever wanted in life. And this is why they can prey on the young so easily, because the young are idealistic. And so it's, you know, the hook and the eye. Here comes the hook. You've got the eye. Bingo. You want the greatest good for the greatest number. That's what we want too, of course. We want peace. We want no more suffering, no more pain, no more poverty, no more inequality, no more injustice. We're going to give it all to you, the best of the best of the best. That's why we're here, and we want you to join us and help us. And that turns out to be collectivism, you see. It's the ultimate bait and switch. And so, you know, I get this over the years, and again, I've become completely immune to it, but people will say, you know, you're exceedingly cruel to me, because what you seem to be saying is that all of these humanitarian impulses that people have are just, you know, sheer crap. They just misunderstand by 180 degrees. And I used to try to explain, you know, individually to people how crazy they were, But now I just write more articles because I don't have the time to do that or the inclination. No, it's the grand deception. This is the grand deception of the empire. This is how you create an army. How do you think you get people to go overseas and die? How do you think you get people to give up what they have? How do you think you get people to deny at the most profound level their own power and their own imagination? You show them something that rings a bell inside them, something they've always wanted, something that seems to be completely selfless and non-commercial and non-profit. And you say, this is who we are, this is what we do, come with us, be part of it, you know. So when I mean, I watch this all the time. I see it playing out. And extreme deception behind it.
There's also a lot of anti-self, anti-ego programming coming out of Hollywood right now. Have you noticed?
Yes, I've noticed that for a long time. Absolutely. You know? Here's a perfect example. Family. I noticed about 20 years ago, 25 years ago maybe, that, you know, show or television, I don't care whether it was a cop show or whether it was the news or whether it was a public service announcement or medical this and that, family, the Godfather, everything is about the family, you know. Where did all this come from all of a sudden? It was as if people never understood what family was before and they had to be educated, which is, of course, absurd, you know. So I said, okay, so this is coming from somewhere. And where it's coming from is, this is how we tame the rebel. The rebel is always at odds with his family, one way or another. And so we tell a little fairy tale for the kiddies where we start, you know, the arc of the story goes from the outsider, the rebel, the loner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it ends with the melting down and the great cosmic cheese of the family. I'm back in the arms of my family again. There is nothing but family. I mean, you can watch television and see this kind of phrase repeated 1,000 different ways. Family is all there is in the end. You know, there's only family. And this goes on and on and on and on. It has no end. And this is one of the ways, for example, of saying, straight out of Hollywood, if you are outside the family, you're a criminal, basically.
Yeah.
You're all ego, and you're all greed, and you're all insanity, and you're all dangerous. Then you come back into the family, and then you're healed.
Yeah, now if you want to pursue your own spiritual destiny, you are a selfish bastard.
Exactly, because look at how many people you're disappointing. You know, look at how many people now see you as being strange. Look at how many people shun you. What gives you the right? You know, this is sort of the caber. What gives you the right to think that you can find your own individual destiny, or even worse, create it? You know, when all of us here huddled together, who love you so much, who want you to be a part of us, are so profoundly disappointed in you, we don't understand you, you're not making any sense anymore, you need psychiatric help, you need drugs, blah, 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 blah. Just come back, you know, and over and over again. And it's repellent, it's disgusting, and I have, you know, lost friends over it. I've lost good friends over it. People who detached themselves from me because they thought, you know, this guy's like a live wire here. Well, you know, there's too much electricity, and he just, you know, not going to take any shit, and he doesn't agree with our principles of the collective. he doesn't see the good of everyone working together to cooperate for a better world. He's against a better world. No, I'm against one world. I'm for many worlds, a lot of worlds, each one invented and created through the imagination and power of the individual, with the one proviso that you don't interfere with the freedom of another, period. You don't try to encroach. So what we're seeing, it's like a steamroller trying to steamroll everybody down to the same size and the same shape and the same composition, while saying that this is the realization, spiritual realization of everything that has ever been wanted by humankind.
It's metaphysical communism. That's what that is.
Yeah. But, the USSR version didn't work. And it didn't work on a lot of different levels, and it didn't work on a psychological level. So it needed a new front. It needed a complete, overhaul and renovation to make it more appealing, to make it softer, to bring in operatives that knew how to play the game in the industrial societies that were basically, at least at one time, free market societies. And so they had to be smarter and more clever and more devious, and they are far more.
Well, this is when the idea of mass harmony, global outlook, collective consciousness is all very dangerous.
That's another great one, collective consciousness. During the 1960s, we saw the import from Asia into America and other countries of a perverted and distorted take on various spiritual systems of India, China, Japan. And brought in was this whole idea of collective consciousness, which is collectivism and globalism at the level of spirit. And it basically said, when you stripped away the embroidery, the ultimate state of consciousness is that state in which we are all one. We're all one. We're the same person. Everything is everything. There is no separation. And, of course, this taps into very deep impulses in people who feel dislocated, disenchanted, lonely, yearning for something, yearning for a connection of some kind, And so they buy it. Well, this is fantastic to know that the universe finally is really all about collective consciousness. What you know is what I know, and vice versa, and we all know everything, and it's all apparent, and it's a revelation, and we can all see it together, and, there we are. And this is the highest goal that can be sought. And this was enormously destructive. I lived through it. I was old enough at the time and already rebellious enough at the time to know what I was looking at when the 60s came and went. And although certain very important things happened in the 60s, at the same time, I was watching people whom I knew commit so slow suicide, physical suicide, spiritual suicide. And at the same time, intentionally lowering their own IQ and giving up completely on their own imagination. And watching that, not a pleasant thing, was very instructive. And it was all about this idea, really. Shared consciousness, collective consciousness. That's what they had opted for, that's what they bought, and it destroyed them.
So do you think parts of the New Age movement then could be manufactured by the Matrix creators?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no question about it. Absolutely, consciously, with full intent to do harm. Aspects of the New Age movement were really invented as a psychological operation, a psyop, a grand psyop from one end of the planet to the other, to bring people into the fold, to destroy the concept of the individual and to replace it with the spiritual collective. No question about it. Absolutely. Absolutely so. And several of the insiders that I have interviewed at length who were involved in psychological operations not only told me as much, but they spelled it out, you know, how it was done and where it was done and the research behind it. So, yes, no question about it.
And what about the psychedelic movement or CIA's involvement with LSD, giving it away at universities?
You bet. You know, there were a lot of people that were unconscious of the design of the whole thing, of course, just like in any conspiracy. And there were people who dropped acid who found that it changed their lives. Yeah. And normally those people were people who did it once or twice. Acid, mescaline, peyote, whatever. Others became crusaders in the cause, you know, and changed the world through LSD. Others were destroyed. But yes, the CIA started out, they were looking for a truth drug, and they went through a whole bunch of them, and they didn't find anything that was reliable, and they went to LSD. And what they discovered with LSD was, it wasn't a truth drug, and this was part of MKUltra, their mind control program that started in roughly 1952. What they discovered was, no, it's not a truth drug, but if we give somebody enough of it, we can put them into a state of absolute terror where they will tell us whatever we want them to tell us. And so they said, this is good. This is an important drug. And so it became part of MKUltra, but then they and other people said, what would happen if we just unleashed this on society completely and made sure that it was distributed far enough and wide enough so that we would, you know, make a social revolution here? What would be the outcome of that? And, you know, there were conferences and papers written and LSD researchers who chimed in and this and that and the other thing, and the conclusion was, people will become, ultimately, more disabled and passive. For example, I know the case of a painter in New York, a good painter, very talented from the time he was a child, who took LSD several times and never painted again for the rest of his life. And I said, well, you know, what'd you do that for? Idiot. And he said, no. He said, I saw things while I was on acid, such fantastic things that I didn't even need to put a brush on canvas after that. I didn't need to do anything. So that's a little cameo. If you multiply that by millions, you begin to see the effects throughout society that rippled during the 1960s. It's here. It's now. I've got it. I saw it. I experienced it. Nothing will ever be the same. And all I need to do now is float through time and space because I'm enlightened. Well, that was just delusory. As people discovered, if they ever, you know, whenever they stopped taking it, and they would have to stop taking it, otherwise it would just kill them physically after a while. And then they were left with nothing.
So do you see the same dangers? We're talking about collective consciousness also within alternative media?
Yeah, unfortunately I do. But I think with the internet, there are self-correcting mechanisms. There are enough people out there digging and digging and digging so that hopefully very good information emerges from a number of different sources which can't be compromised. I mean, that's what the web gives you as the potential. But sure, I mean, I saw that as a reporter before I, you know, even got out of the business. The alternative media at that time were free newspapers and small magazines. And there were certain stories that I would propose and, you know, get shot down every time. And that's still the case. You know, I've written for, I could think of one alternative web magazine. I sent them an article. I gave them my background, and they said, this is fabulous, we're going to print this, and bang, it appeared the next day, and I sent them another article, and they rejected it, and I sent them another one, and they said, sorry, we can't publish this or anything that you give us. So I looked at the webzine again, checked it out, and I saw, ah, okay, it's political. I'm talking about the individual. Somebody went to my website, and they started reading, you know, everything at No More Fake News, and they saw, oh, this guy is, he takes it too far. And he's criticizing everybody. You know, Robert Anton Wilson once said, the people on the political left hate corporations, the people on the political right hate the government. I mean, yeah, and they're both right. But the implication being they're both idiots because they can only see half the picture. It's the mega, mega size and the control that emanates from both areas, you know, working in conjunction with each other that creates the problem. So there is, you know, there are alternatives on the left, alternatives on the right, and you can't get in, even if you wanted to, unless you toe the party line. So, yeah, there is definitely that happening in the alternative media. And the one thing that I'll say I rarely find it in the alternative media is an understanding of this war between the artist and the system, between the individual with all, you know, all power there, theoretically, versus the collective with all power there. If you start to paint that in stark enough terms, a whole lot of people that are consider themselves alternative are going to reject you.
Oh, yeah.
They don't like that at all.
I know.
They do not like that at all. So I'm gathering from this conversation here that you've been through a lot of this yourself.
Sure, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is what happens, you know, because it's harder to deal with it on a stark level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's much easier if you sort of melt in the edges on both and you try to meet in the middle and let's compromise and, you know, it's not that bad and, you know, all of this kind of insanity. And people stake out these kind of compromised positions and then you come on the scene and they take one look at you and they run screaming into the night. They don't want to have anything to do with you.
Yeah.
But from my own experience, I have to say, and this has been the last maybe 2 years, the audience for my work has been expanding geometrically. So they're out there, individuals. They're looking for something that isn't just the easy way out. They've reached the end of their tether. They've got nowhere to go. And they want to find more answers than they found themselves. And the number of these people is much greater than I ever imagined. Except, you see, because they're individuals, you can't find them in one place.
And they stay quieter. They're not commenting on other people's stuff all the time.
That's right. Yeah.
They're too busy making their own.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's what they're doing. But they also feel the pinch and the pressure. They can see what's coming down the pipeline. And they want out. And if they're already out, they want to get further out than out. They want something beyond where they've, you know, arrived at themselves. And when I wrote The Secret Behind Secret Societies, I said that, you know, there are two great themes in history, in hidden history, unwritten history: the formula of the secret society and the tradition of imagination. The tradition of imagination is not to be found in one place, in one time, or one group, but conscious or unconscious, you will see it embodied in every artist who's ever lived on the planet. You'll see it in other places, here and there, throughout history. And that tradition is of the individual, and individual power as expressed through creative force, which is really the only way that it can be expressed. Ultimately, because that way invents new realities. And so, if people want to think about something esoteric, if we were to look at the future of the planet and imagine for a moment that we were seeing, let's say, 50 million individuals, each equipped, remembering, knowing, being able to deploy his or her own creative power and imagination to the fullest to create reality, what kind of future would we actually encounter up the road? And the first thing that we would know is it would not be one future. And that's one of the things that people can't, you know, who are incapable of thinking it through, can't handle, because they can't fit it into a neat picture. What we will see is a multiplicity of powerful realities replacing centralized reality that we know today. And it will be at every single possible level that you can conceive of. The decentralization of power will be so enormous that we wouldn't even recognize that future compared, contrasted with what we've got now or ever had before. It would not be one thing, to repeat myself. It would be millions of different things, each so extraordinarily powerful that space and time as we know it would not exist in the same way anymore.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah. That's what I'm looking at.
As we begin to wrap up here, I wanted to read one more line from The Artist Against the System. You say, "The artist isn't looking for the one thing that will unite us all under a banner of harmony. He knows all such harmonies wear out and are eventually co-opted to produce mass hypnosis."
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what somewhere in the human mind, there is a tendency to appreciate the aesthetics of harmony, symmetry, balance, equilibrium, ordinary perspective, so to speak, from the painter's point of view, the classical elements, geometry, geometric shapes, and so on. These can be tapped into, and they are tapped into by not only classical artists, but by controllers of the mind, who know that people have this sector, let's say, in their psyche that is very much attracted to that, especially harmony. And so if you show harmony to people over and over and over again in pictorial form, in verbal form, whatever it is, in many different ways, from the crudest to the most subtle, you will attract an audience. And so I have observed the most incredible towering tonnage of bullshit being presented to people, which they buy. They buy it as ultimate reality, not as something interesting, not as one of many possible ways of deploying imagination and creating, but as something ultimate, such as sacred geometry, for example, which has become very big among the New Age spiritual crowd because, yeah, the physical universe happens to repeat mathematical patterns. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Is it ultimate spirit of some kind? Are you out of your mind? But it can be couched in terms of immense discovery, awesome knowledge, which if we attach ourselves to, like ants to honey, we can become spiritually transformed and once again enter into the collective consciousness of the universe, which has been only waiting for us to arrive, etc., etc. This is complete deception. This is preying upon an impulse, a human impulse, to appreciate harmony, symmetry, balance, equilibrium, geometry, etc., etc., etc. And it is one of the weapons of psychological warfare.
Well, John, I want to thank you for your time today. This has been great for me.
And great for me, too. And I had no preconceptions, but, now that we've had this discussion, I could probably turn around and interview you and find out some fascinating things. I appreciate the time and the conversation.
Will you also please mention your websites and any other details you'd like to mention?
Sure. NoMoreFakeNews.com. It's been around now for, I guess, 12 years. And you'll see right on the home page all my recent articles. I write articles frequently. And you'll also see a couple of graphics about the two collections that people can order, and they are The Matrix Revealed and Exit from the Matrix. So that's basically it.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
And to everyone listening, thank you. Stay creative and have some fun outside the Matrix this evening. We'll talk again soon.
Bye.